All right, welcome everyone to this Tuesday's this week's W3C CCG meeting. So this week we have two main agendas. One, we invited Nico, the author of the SSI on Blockchain is a Bad Idea paper, and to kind of share his thoughts. And in addition to that, we would like to talk about a potential proposal on potentially tweaking our charters, and I think Kimberly can actually talk about that a little bit later. Any agendas that people want to bring up? All right, so before we get to the agendas and introductions, just want to do a quick reminder on the code of ethics. In summary, just make sure that you know, we create and you know, maintain a psychologically safe environment where people feel comfortable sharing their thoughts. I'm sure that sometimes we don't necessarily agree with each other, but let's make sure that the respect is there. All right, a quick IP note. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So the links are included in the agenda email that's sent out. Make sure you have a W3 account and sign the W3C community contributor license agreement. These minutes and the audio recording of everything said on this call are archived with at the W3C GitHub meetings link. We actually have fixed the recording, so that you can see the recordings in the links that I've sent out. We use IRC to queue speakers during the call, as well as to take minutes. So type in Q plus to add yourself to the queue if you have any questions. Q minus to remove your questions from the queue. And you know, if you have any questions, just feel free to do the Q plus, and then I will acknowledge you and monitor the questions and acknowledge you. Any introductions and reintroductions? Anyone new to the community or haven't been active and want to kind of reintroduce yourself? All right, I will make sure that we have set aside some time for introductions, reintroductions at the end of the meeting as well. Any announcements or reminders? I think as a public service announcement, the IIW Internet Identity Workshop is in November, so if you haven't actually signed up for that, just sign up. All right, Mike, I think you have a question.
Yeah, actually, just more of an announcement. 115, ITF 115 is coming up. I think most people are aware of that. The hybrid and remote stuff has been working pretty well also. It was sometimes difficult, but that's been working extremely well for the last few IETFs. So there are items, in particular SCIT, so SCITT, is formed as a working group now, and kicking off during this meeting. Looks like Jose, so JavaScript Object Signing Encryption, will be forming as also. So there will be some stuff that has definite impact, particularly for the underlying primitives we use in a lot of our specs here. So
great. Thanks, Mike. Any other announcements or reminders? Any progress or action reports on the action items? All right, before we get to the main agenda and welcome Nico, Kimberly, do you want to kind of bring up the other agenda in regards to the charter?
Sure, sure. Thanks, Harrison. So we have been discussing the CCG charter, and I just want to put it in the chat. And also, just in case folks don't have it, let me read it. It's pretty short. The mission of the W3C Credentials Community Group is to explore the creation, storage, presentation, verification, and user control of credentials. We focus on a verifiable credential, a set of claims created by an issuer and about a subject, a person, group, or thing, and seek solutions inclusive of approaches such as self-sovereign identity, presentation of proofs by the bearer, data minimalization, and centralized, federated, and decentralized registry and identity systems. Our tasks include drafting and incubating internet specifications for further standardization and prototyping and testing reference implementations. So that charter definitely, I think, gives a good sense of what we do here, but it doesn't make any mention of DIDs or of the VC standard. And that has actually started to create some real confusion in the community at large outside of CCG, to the point where there actually were some folks starting a community group to talk about DIDs. And so we've begun to just sort of wonder about whether or not we need to add something to our charter about the work that we are doing in those areas. And, but before we really started drafting a new charter or adding to the charter, we wanted to just bring it to you all as a community and get your feedback and input about whether or not you think this change is even necessary. So I just like to open it to the floor to have questions and discussion around that. Anybody feel strongly about not changing the charter to include those things? Tall Ted.
Yeah. I don't feel strongly about it, but it does seem apparent that it's necessary, given that there was another group already starting to try to have a conversation that we are already having. I'm not sure what shape that adjustment needs to be, whether it actually needs to be a charter change or simply acknowledging the fact that we produced the original DIDs, et cetera, or the pre-working group document that went into the working group. So to try to be a little clearer, because I'm a little not awake today, summarizing the work that has been done here and the work that is ongoing does not seem to me to require to change the charter. It just needs to be documented. So there might be an informative section of the charter as opposed to normative, and we could do that, I think, pretty instantly. That's it.
Thanks. That would be great. Mike?
Yeah, I was going to note, Ted, that's actually a great thought about kind of some non-normative language. One of the things the chairs have been running into is we can't actually edit the CCG page. So we're chasing that down and trying to find out why that anything under CCG, we can't do that correctly. Friends, I love your music. There we go. Cool. But yeah, that's an excellent thought. So we've got kind of a parallel item to see if W3C staff actually has to update the community group page itself, and that looks to be the case, but we're getting some details on that, Ted. So
Harrison?
Yeah, I would just like to add that the chairs has received, like, I think one or two feedback in regards to the current charter being a little bit, for lack of a better term, confusing. It is quite wordy, and so the feedback was if we could actually simplify and clarify it further. So it's not a specific. So I think adding VCs or DIDs, like those kind of languages, like is something that's nice, right? Because, for example, verifiable credentials is gaining quite a bit of, more and more recognition. So that could help, you know, kind of help clarify, what we do here. But I think, more or less the main thing is about, clean up the language to, make it more, for lack of a better term, understandable, right? For people who are not as familiar, with this community. Yeah.
Yes, this process of going through a new proposed charter would give us the opportunity to make edits to the whole thing. So that's definitely a thought too. So unless anyone is strongly objecting, my next ask is for anybody who's interested in sort of volunteering to look at the language, and provide some suggestions. You can raise your hand here if you want to, or you can just reach out to me separately and we can talk about how we're gonna move forward with, looking at the language. And, Ted, I would definitely appreciate your historical wisdom on, you know, what is non-normative. That would be great. So. Any other questions or comments about this? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kimberly. All right, any other announcements or reminders or agenda that people want to bring up? All right, so let's get to the main agenda, talking about SSI on blockchain. So 3 months ago, I read a great research paper by Nico. Actually, the backstory is I was just perusing Kalia's newsletter, and then I saw this article, and I read deeper into it. I found it very, very insightful and very, very thorough. So we're very, very pleased to actually invite Nico, the author, to kind of talk about SSI on blockchain and his insights from his research. You know, I know SSI, blockchain, Web3, you know, or the intersection of all these topics and hype terms has been a debated topic in this community for the past few years. So I think, you know, it's going to be interesting, right, to actually have Nico kind of bring his perspective and share his thoughts. So anyway, so without further ado, I'll just welcome Nico to the floor, and then kind of have him start by kind of sharing what he found, right, and his thoughts in regards to why SSI on blockchain is might be a bad idea. Thank you, Nico.
Yeah, hi. I'm Nico. I'm a site reliability engineer at a rather large IT company, which I prefer to leave unnamed. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for inviting me here. My interest is mainly in blockchain, not necessarily, like, SSI was more of a bit of an accident, I guess. So apologies if I get, like, some of the terminology wrong. Additionally, maybe just one more thing, before I get started here. I woke up with a sore throat. So if I do lose my voice or cough, in the middle of the talk, my apologies. So I'll start with, like, summarizing, sort of just going just really quick through my background and, then summarizing the main points of the article. I'll see if I can hit some of the 15-minute mark approximately. My at work, I focus on distributed databases and privacy engineering. And in a previous life, I used to work in fintech. So there is a bit of a, you know, like, I guess I have a bit of a predisposition for blockchain and crypto stuff, though my interest is mostly in blockchain, less the crypto, aspects of that sort of ecosystem. I got really sucked into, in quotes, into the blockchain stuff around, like, 2016, 2017. I played around before as a hobbyist, and then around 16, 17, I started comparing sort of blockchain as a tech stack with my work experience in quote unquote big tech. And I started to realize that I struggled both myself and also like trying to figure out how to do that, but also like getting the information from other people, how to do that, how to sort of apply the blockchain tech stack to the problems that I was seeing, in my day-to-day work experience. Anything from functionality, privacy, compliance, policy, scaling, usability. Blockchain seemed to be lacking functionality, not just a bit, and like, you know, like, okay, there's like, you know, because it's a new technology, there's just like chunks missing, but like fundamental issues with the technology. So I kept getting involved in like the blockchain engineering discussions, and eventually, it took me 5 years, I guess, to get to that point, but eventually I started, you know, actually writing things down into a blog post, or blog posts, I guess. The key point in that blog post is I generally really like the idea of self-sovereign identity. One more thing. I'm speaking, as this is my personal opinion, not the one of my employer who may or may not have a single sign-on product. I personally really like the idea of decentralizing these kind of things. I think this is the hyper-centralization of, identity services is a, present and relevant problem that needs addressing. But I also don't see how blockchain is needed. I don't think blockchain helps the user. And I do think blockchain slows adoption of self-sovereign identity. And, it creates much more problems than it actually solves. I think a good example that I found, like that I also cited in the blog, is the European Union COVID vaccine passport, which to my knowledge used the W3C verifiable credentials. And initially, when they were trying to set this up in the beginning of the pandemic, they tried to put this on blockchain. They failed. Then they removed the blockchain parts. And with reasonable decentralization, like individual countries issue, like their certificates and pharmacies, they managed to scale this up to 2 billion certificates. And in a way, this is kind of the, you know, QR code on paper, is kind of the benchmark that, you know, in a way blockchain needs to reach. And I think a lot of effort is from at least sort of the research that I've done and like the projects that I've seen, a lot of effort is trying to make blockchain work as good as a QR code on paper. Now I will say, I have, like, this is not something that's SSI specific. Other projects like logistics or social media have, very similar problems when, you know, blockchain gets involved. The reason why I wrote about SSI specifically is simply because that blog post was done first. And then I got married and bought a house and didn't have time to finish the other ones. Eventually. One day. Okay. So I'm going to go through like the main sort of, advantages that I often saw cited in, blockchain DLT integrations. I'm going to go over these rather quickly, and like I'm very happy to answer more in-depth questions during the Q&A later. So one of the things that often comes up is that anything really, or digital identifiers or verifiable credentials on a blockchain are inherently more trusted for some reason. I really barely ever found that claim substantiated in any way, and it doesn't really make sense on a high level, right? Because if anyone can write to a DLT, then the fact that it is on a DLT or a blockchain doesn't add anything like trust by itself, right? Vice versa, like if you have a centralized, like a permissioned blockchain, well, you really kind of don't get any of the supposed advantages of blockchain technologies, right? Like the trust is now delegated to the operator of that, say Hyperledger instance. I think Sovereign is an example of a company that does that. Like, okay, well, but now they effectively gate the, what is on that blockchain or not. A similar argument often comes up with that the, issuers of the certificates, like say, like governments or, Universities, for example, are more trusted through having their certificates being on the blockchain. But the same argument holds here too, right? If anyone can write to it, it doesn't really add trust. If only few people can write to it, the trust just delegated. And we have the same model as with the PKI structure that you have today in browsers like Chrome or Safari, where a company or very few entities decide who is trusted or not. So the second sort of bigger point like of advantages are is forgery resistance. To quote from some sovereign white paper, I think, there's the thing that the argument that the blockchain can tell you which certificate is the most recent one. But this is very hard to get right in a privacy preserving way. I'm sure there's like odd edge cases, like domain TLS certificates would be something where this is possible and this is also done using certificate transparency. But for the average use case of like, say, you know, something that is clearly linked to a person, let's use a passport as an example, this does not work in a privacy preserving way, right? Because if you, the bot notifications distracted me real quick. If you want to check whether there is a second copy, like a second passport in my name on the ledger, that requires some way of looking up in the ledger whether, you know, for Nikolai V, there is a second passport in the ledger. Now, this is clearly a GDPR concern or even a violation if I cannot change or remove that entry. GDPR requires me to be able to erase or rectify any kind of data that is stored by any entity that is linkable to me. And the answer to that often comes up is, oh, we'll just use zero knowledge proofs, but that doesn't really change the fundamental issue, right? Like, as someone who verifies my identity, that person needs to be able to look up whether there's a fraudulent copy of that ID given some attributes that are clearly linked to me. That is the GDPR violation. If you wrap that in zero knowledge proofs, it doesn't really change the fact. I think I'm happy to talk about GDPR a bit more during the Q&A. It actually is much worse than that, and there's lots of legal uncertainty even when it comes to Bitcoin transactions, because these are technically linkable to individuals too. Another related thing to forgery is verified timestamping. And verified timestamping is one of those things where there's at least somewhat of a technical argument that is, you know, starts at here's a problem and here's the solution, how we address this, which frankly is something I was had a really hard time finding for a lot of other, blockchain and SSI integrations. So verified timestamping effectively gives you an upper and or lower bound for when a document was issued, right? It's included in the Merkle tree and some DLT, so it's kind of bounded by when the blocks or the Merkle nodes were issued. Now, this kind of sounds useful, and certificate transparency, for example, does that too, but it's also really hard, at least for me, to come up with a concrete example, like an actual real world use case where this makes sense. If you go through the passport model, for example, right? This would only be useful if you have a passport in your hand and you do not dispute name, eye color, date of birth, the ID, government ID number, the issuance date on the passport, the expiration date on the passport. But somehow what you really don't trust, really want to verify, is when that passport was printed, right? This just doesn't really seem like a real life use case to me. And, you know, furthermore, the issuer could just create multiple copies, which you can't detect because of the fraud, the forgery, proof problems that we just discussed. And also, timestamping services already exist, right? There's RFC 3161. You can also use DKIM. It's just barely used because, like, I don't think this problem ever really comes up in practice. Another issue that is also very related to the forgery thing is there are very valid reasons for backdating documents, for quote-unquote creating forged documents. This can be anything from, you know, victims of domestic violence that change their name. There's people that go into witness protection program, people that transition genders, or just like a plain old typo, right? Shining a spotlight on, you know, here's a digital identity that has been modified somehow, can, you know, I don't want to go like the full length where I'm going to say like this can put like people's life in danger, but it certainly is a bit more of a nuanced discussion. So the, just going like, oh, we'll just like have like a hard proof that this is accurate, like doesn't really meet the reality of, or the complexities of the, situation, I think. Alright, so the last sort of two main points were, is like reliance on third parties and whether you own your data. And I don't think either of these two things hold either. I think the reliance on third parties, is actually kind of increases because like your smartphone is not realistically going to restore a full copy of a blockchain system that scales to say like 300 million American digital identifiers. Even if it can store, it's not going to maintain like live updates of that. So you will have to rely on some third party API that manages the blockchain for you, which right now, if you look at the sort of ecosystem of, you know, third-party gateways in the cryptocurrency or like blockchain ecosystem, you have Infura, which is kind of implicated in the censorship around what's it called again, the Tornado Cash thing, for example. And these third parties have their own financial incentives, right? They can serve you wrong, missing and delayed data. If, you know, they think this makes them more money, right? There's plenty of examples in the sort of payment ecosystem, for example, where credit card companies just like, even if there's no regulatory, like direct reason to ban a provider, they just don't want to deal with the PR of it, right? Like, erotic, content sites are the common examples. OnlyFans, for example, where payment providers just like shut them down. So you have like, you're effectively putting your trust in, at this point, unregulated API gateways. So it's not that the reliance on third parties decreases here. And the own your data argument, finally, is I just don't see how this is true. If you're broadcasting your data onto a public ledger, everyone owns it, right? Including all of big tech and all of the NSA and other secret services. You can't really delete from it. I mean, like, If your threat model is that big tech or the NSA is, you know, listening to you and grabbing your data, then now your threat model not only increases from does not only contain like this one big tech that you store your data with, it includes all big techs and all worldwide secret services, right? The common argument that people are like, oh, like why this is not a problem is we'll just use encryption, but that's orthogonal to blockchain stuff, right? If you encrypt your data in a way that it's safe enough to put it on a public blockchain so that it's safe, like it's defensible against every secret service and every big tech, then it's safe enough for Dropbox, right? You can put it on Dropbox. And in addition, you get GDPR enforcement against Dropbox. You can sue Dropbox if they mishandle your data. You don't get Chainalytics metadata analysis, which is something you also get on public blockchains where, you know, Chainalytics business model is, you know, de-anonymizing people. This clearly is a threat. So the own your data argument just does not, I just cannot see how this works. So these are the supposed quote unquote good sides. But you also get them, as with every technology that you integrate into a system, you get additional complexity, right? You get cost, you get dev time, compliance, and I've made that, you know, semi-joke before that a lot of time is being spent making DLT work as good as a QR code printed on a piece of paper. And I found a lot of projects that were stuck in this phase, really. like a lot of problems are working, trying to work around the GPR issues, around the, you know, we can't delete things. You get an online requirement, for example. If you want your ID checked and you're in some, say, Berlin underground club where there's no or poor internet reception, right? Like, your QR code on paper is going to work. Your blockchain enabled thing that needs like an internet connection is not. If you have a big festival in the desert, for example, somewhere in the countryside where the internet is slow or broken, you'll run into the same problems. For public ledgers, you have transaction costs, and of course, you have GDPR and meta-analysis privacy problems. So none of these problems that you add would be deal breakers if they were offset by actual advantages. But again, I am having a really hard time finding those. So I'm going to go really quick about the literature part, because I think the literature part is really just like me going through various, you know, various blog posts and academic literature, going from actually trying to extract information to just being at times a bit moody and ranty about the unfortunately poor quality of some of the articles. Just to give you maybe one or two examples, like the EBSI, the European Blockchain Initiative, for example, like there, if you dig into their documentation far enough, you'll finally find a diagram where they describe how they are using the DLT, and they use it for writes only. There's only arrows that write to the ledger. No workflow reads from it. At the time I looked at it, at least. Maybe they added something, but at the time, that was all there was. IBM says on their blogs that, you know, their blockchain integration will avoid third parties, but they ignore that, you know, most or all their blockchain products require that you log in through IBM.com, with an IBM.com login, which is, you know, a bit of a third party. I think my favorite one was Forbes, like one of the biggest, like first Google results when you Google for like blockchain as I was is a Forbes article, and they claim that DID on DLT will allow that online shopping will be delivered to wherever you are at the moment, which I thought was they didn't substantiate that claim, let's put it that way. I found similar results on a slightly higher level on sort of the academic literature. I will say there's a ton of research, like articles here, and obviously I didn't, you know, go through all of them. I went through the top five results, top five most cited results on Google Scholar on the subject. I found similar results to the blog articles, where there's a lot of claims that are simply then not followed up on or substantiated. Some of the academic literature at least pointed out some of the same problems that I mentioned before. I think my favorite point there was that one of the papers claimed that that DLT would allow in some cases for real-time proof of correctness, for example, that you're not a terrorist when you're checking into the airport. And I thought that was I didn't know finding out whether someone's a terrorist is as easy as putting that into that piece of data into a blockchain. And I went through a couple of real world projects. I found like, I assembled them from the blog posts and the articles that I looked through before. And I think I'm guessing the numbers, like about the 15 projects, like say 10 projects, 7 were dead, 2 stopped doing blockchain, and the remaining one, Sovereign, they effectively, run a private Hyperledger instance. And I reached out to them because they had one example where the International Aviation Transit Authority, IATA, I think, they were having a partnership with them, and I reached out to them, like, do they use blockchain? And then they effectively admitted that, well, they don't actually. Like, they run their own, whatever, like, centralized database, and we just, you know, give them a copy of our internal Hyperledger instance, like a data dump, and they play that into their database. They also said that they're exploring other options other than DLT, so they're kind of moving away from it too. the real world projects, and I mentioned earlier that like this is not necessarily SSI specific. The only second article that I wrote on my blog was that I looked into a total of 34 quote unquote real life blockchain projects, and I found exactly the same results across the board with other non-SSI blockchain integrations. So to summarize, I think SSI is an extremely interesting area of research. I think this is a thing that solves a problem that is present, as I said before. But there's plenty of hard problems, right? Like things like from like, you know, privacy, metadata resistance, how you deal with identity theft, how you make it work for tech illiterate people, which is really sort of the main anti-SSI argument that I see from, you know, my friend circle. These are really interesting, fun, and challenging problems. And I am biased here because like I am from the sort of blockchain skeptic ecosystem, but I do feel a lot of work is being put into making blockchain as useful as MySQL that instead could be spent on, you know, actually solving the hard problems that would benefit the end user. And that's the summary. I hope that was a useful summary.
Thank you, Nico. Any questions? Alan.
I was trying to figure out how to unmute. So how do I prove ownership of a DID if there isn't some sort of a agreed upon place to make that claim?
I mean, you would have your private key that matches the public key encoded in the DID, right?
Right, but somebody else could produce the same DID with a different key.
Right. So this, I think, goes into the forgery aspect, right? Like, how do you avoid that there's two DIDs referring to the same individual, right?
But you cannot. No, two DIDs referring to different. I create a DID, put my key, have my DID doc and all that. You come along and use the same DID, but with your own key and your own DID doc. And now a third party comes along and doesn't know which is which.
Right. What is in the DID here though? Like what is the thing that's effectively signed off when you create the DID?
Well, you know, a claim that I'm Alan Karp and I live in a particular place, whatever. It's a DID doc that I think that matters here.
Right.
And then you claim that you're Alan Karp who lives in a different place or whatever.
Right. But that is a thing that I can do on the blockchain too, right? I can just upload the DID to the blockchain and now there's two DIDs that say Alan Karp are on the blockchain.
Right. But as I understand the rules, only the first one wins.
The first one is determined by what, right? So there's going to be like 300 million DIDs, on the blockchain. And as we discussed, as I mentioned before, for privacy reasons, you cannot have literally Alan Karp in there or a hash of Alan Karp in there because that would be a GDPR violation.
Right. But if the DID is going to be useful at all, I think you should be able to guarantee that the first one to claim the DID owns it and can put whatever they want in their DID doc. And somebody else who comes along and claims the same DID should not be recognized as owning that DID.
Right. But again, right, like there's no way to determine whether there is a previous instance of that DID on the blockchain. So the only thing that you could potentially do is refer to the timestamp that is encoded in, like, with the DID on the blockchain, right? Like, so right. The verified timestamping argument.
No, it's the deepest in the chain is the winner.
Right. I think this is somewhat related to the timestamping thing, right? Like,
yeah,
the
it's order, but it doesn't depend on time. It's just the
right.
First one, first block on it to claim the DID
Right. Oh. So, I mean, in the scenario where someone is presented with both DITs, right? So if the person was just presented with one of these, there was no way to tell which one is the true Alan Karp DIT, right?
Sure there is. Sure there is. They walk the chain, see if there's an earlier one. Now, that might be computationally expensive, but at least it's possible.
But they wouldn't be able to find an earlier one that says Alan Karp on it.
Because, no. They did. The DID itself is what they'd search for. We have two people claiming ownership of the same DID. One is earlier on the chain than the other.
Oh, okay. Right. So what exactly is, sorry, like, what exactly are you putting on the chain? You're putting the signature of the DID on the chain.
I'm putting the DID and the public key of the DID, and then I can associate whatever else I want with the DID doc.
Right. So I think this is still like related to the trusted timestamping argument. There's really sorry, I got to stop my thoughts here. This kind of like safety mechanism. Okay, sorry. I think I know what you're getting at. Let me think about that. I really like this. Thank you so much. Like this is the kind of stuff that I was not finding in the research here. I'm trying to think of like a concrete example how this comes into play though.
Actually, sorry, Nico, I think maybe you can formulate your thoughts and then take it offline. We have other questions.
Sure.
So thank you, absolutely. Alan. Thank you, Alan.
So sorry for blanking you.
Yeah, no problem. I think this question is specifically in regards to putting DIDs on blockchains. I think in your research, you mentioned about not putting personal information and PII or VCs, verifiable credentials, on blockchain. I think that's a bad idea. This mm-hmm. question is more specifically about DIDs on blockchain. So I think maybe we can take this offline, and we'll have other people in the queue. All right. So let me see the queue. Keith?
Thanks for your presentation, Nico. I think it might be useful to go through just like a little history of credentials on blockchain. Like in historically, there was some platforms putting VCs, and when we say VCs, we kind of mean PII on blockchain. I guess BlockCerts would be a good example of that. But I think in the last few years, there's no more SSI platforms that, at least no popular SSI platforms that put PII on blockchain anymore. I think most of us are using blockchain for things like putting DIDs on, which is really around key management, but no PII. Now, you can get into a question about the holder DID, and even some platforms are no longer even putting holder DIDs. Anything that even resembles PII is not going on blockchain anymore. And then we put things like schemas on blockchain, revocation mechanisms sometimes go on blockchain. So I think maybe it's just a progression in the industry. I think you cited Sovereign a few times. Like Sovereign never, you know, they have a large DPIA about, you know, PII on blockchain is quite well written. I mean, typically they were putting things like issuer DIDs, cred defs, schemas on blockchain, but they would never put PII on. I mean, they had extreme measures to make sure that no PII ever went on blockchain. So just a couple, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I did kind of see that too when I was going through projects that, you know, like were still alive, that Sovereign in particular, I saw that document where they talked about avoiding PII on blockchain. But again, like this is, you're kind of starting to wonder, like, why are things on blockchain? Like revocation lists, for example, is a good example. Like, we have those already, right? Like they work good enough for real life purposes. I personally don't see like why, you know, what the advantage is of putting these in a, you know, blockchain, for example. So you mentioned like one or two other things that I unfortunately missed.
Yeah, and I think that's the main conversation today is those other things, like particularly did schemas, revocation, should they be on a blockchain or not? I think that's the center of a lot of our conversations these days. Okay.
I do maybe want to go back to Alan's point real quick, because if I understood it correctly, like you have the signature and the DID on sort of that mapping on the blockchain. Right? But what happens if like you, for example, rotate your key, right? What stops me from creating a new DID, for example, that says Alan Karp and sign that myself? That is, has a different hash than, the one that, you present. Right. Maybe I shouldn't,
Right. That's not the issue. That's fine. That can always happen, but it's just somebody else claiming a DID that I claimed first. That's the issue.
Right. I'm really happy to take this offline, but I would love to see like a concrete example where this comes into play, because I think this doesn't strike me as like a real life sort of problem. I think.
All right, Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a use case on this same discussion we're having. And imagine that you're in some trading network of loosely connected trading partners, and say a partner presents me a credential and they need to prove something legally before I can interact with them for global trade. And then, you know, our lives go on. And then in some time in the future, a regulator comes back to me and says, well, did you verify that partner's credential? And what proof do you have that that credential verified at that specific time? Because right now, of course, keys have rotated, revocation lists have changed. So what do I need to cryptographically prove that, yes, I validated that credential at the time? And I think that comes back to these same two things. Like, how is the DID document stored, and can I get a copy from that time? Because keys may have changed. And it might have been at the time I used a key that's now not in the DID doc anymore. And the second is a revocation list. Unless I keep a copy of that signed list with that credential, in a future time, I might not be able to prove that that credential was revoked or not revoked, unless there's some time recorded history like blockchain. So Nico, I wanted to pass that back to you as a potential way to kind of think about this as a trading partner. In the future, I have to prove that I did validate a credential, that someone did pass some certificate test. And what do I need to do to cryptographically prove that? And what is the lift on me as the person who has to prove that to a regulator?
Right. Thank you for that. The timestamping servers is really the main answer for the time recorded history. These things already exist. It is effectively a trusted third party like DigiCert or Google or whatever. Like they and any number of these effectively signing off on a timestamp. This happens implicitly when you send emails. So really, when you internally in your company have a conversation about, verifying that, that trading partner, for example, the email track record will implicitly already have, the cryptographically verified signatures and the timestamp signatures, that prove that you actually did this at the time. Now, of course, you can make the argument, we want to, automate this and you want to like have a more standardized flow around digital credentials or verifiable credentials, for example. But I do think, and I do think that that's fair, that's fine. But like the technology for this is already there, right? The technology that timestamps the things and that, makes things auditable way into the past is already there. It has been there for 30 years.
Yeah, I think the question for me is more like, okay, I'm signing in to use this W3 system, their verifiable credentials, their revocation lists. Like, what's the standard way to do this? Do I mandate my trading partners go put these timestamps in their messages? Because if I receive an email from them with a timestamp, all that proves is I received it. It doesn't prove that I validated it. And if I send an email back that said, oh, I just want to send you this email to let you know this really did validate, that feels to me like weak evidence because it doesn't really show that I did validate it.
Right. I think in that case, it really means, like, the question is really, what does validation mean in this context? Is it like a cryptographic validation?
Well, it's very clear that I have to prove to a regulator that I followed the rules at the time. And if the rules were the time to prove that that person was a registered licensee of some trading characteristic, then a cryptographic proof may be the right way to do it. I could, of course, go back to paper documents and phone calls and records, but I think that this technology is trying to get us beyond that.
Right. I am very, very happy with the verifiable credentials and the DID and the sort of approach of like creating a better way of creating standardized way of asserting certain facts. I think that my personal opinion, as someone who has been involved in the PGP and GPG ecosystem for a while, it's a mess. It's hard to use. It's bad. The X509 signing system is not exactly user friendly either. So I do think the idea of creating, you know, a better standard for signing off on facts is an absolutely great thing to have. Again, like my only angle here is like, does this require blockchain? And if the technology for timestamping a certain fact is already here, it doesn't need a blockchain system. So in your example, like if you have the mechanism to demonstrate that you audited some sort of, you know, regulatory requirements, then you can record that fact in, you know, say a verifiable credential or like a sort of some DID document, and then you can have that timestamp by a timestamping server, for example. Like this technology already exists. Like I don't think the complexity overhead of doing a DLT adds anything of value here. If that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you. Marcus?
Yeah. Hey,
Phil, do you mind muting?
I wanted to say just a few words about the question of how do you prevent someone else from claiming the same deed with a different deed document. So that is the job of the deed method to ensure that, right? In most deed methods, you cannot actually arbitrarily choose your deed, so you cannot just claim any string as a deed, but instead the deed is somehow guaranteed cryptographically or by the deed method to be unique. For example, one of the earliest blockchain-based deed methods, which was BTCR. In that case, the deed is not, for example, a UUID that you can just claim and write to the blockchain, but in that case, the deed is actually an address on the blockchain. It's a pointer to a specific transaction on the chain, and that will only ever point to one place on the blockchain, so you cannot associate another deed document and claim that as yours. With some other deed methods like deed key, for example, the deed itself is derived from a public key, right? So that the deed itself is your key. So you cannot just use a different deed document and claim that to be the correct deed document. And so again, this is what deed methods are expected to guarantee. This is what the deed resolution process makes sure that you actually get the correct deed document for the deed. And in the deed specification, we also use the term of a verifiable data registry, right? So that there's the assumption that the deed and the deed document is created and then resolved from some kind of verifiable data layer or data network. And so it simply doesn't work like that, where anyone can just claim an identifier and an associated deed document. You have to go through the creation and resolution process defined by the deed method.
Right. Thanks for that. So this kind of brings me maybe a bit back to the, what is the concrete like workflow and or use case here? That argument I mentioned earlier. Right?
Yeah. Can I speak to that? I'm next on the queue and I think we have 4 minutes left.
Sure.
Yeah. Christina. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, we can discuss multiple deployment models, multiple things to be written on blockchain. And I think you're right that like a blockchain is not an absolute necessity in realizing the issuer holder verifier model that verifiable credentials enable, but it can be useful, right? And one place it can be useful is writing the actual decentralized identifiers on the chain. And why? Because, and mainly the IDs of the users, individual users, right? So I'm sure, as you know, verifiable credentials, when they are presented as verifiable presentations with holder binding, they need, the verifier needs the holder's keys to verify the signature on the presentation. And if it's a signature by the issuer, which is, you know, usually a company, an enterprise, to get the keys of that company, you know, you can use multiple existing mechanisms like X549 certs or, you know, .well-known, GWKS URI, like whatnot. But how do you find the keys of an individual user? Seriously, like if it's a user's, you know, we can't expect every single individual to host a domain. So we can put .well-known and then attach GWKS URI. We can expect to issue X549 to every single individual. So that's where, you know, can we have this public place? And again, we can debate what kind of blockchain type is best suited, but can we have this public place where anyone can look up that identifier to the key to be able to verify that holder binding signature on the verifiable presentation? And to your point, and the reason why I said it's not absolute necessity, because if you don't care about key rotation and you don't care about finding any other information other than just public keys, because you can put not just public keys, but other information, other service endpoints to the DID document too. Like if you don't care about that, go ahead and pass a raw public key in a verifiable credential. So the verifier just, you know, uses that raw public key to verify the signature on the presentation. Like that's where that blockchain piece would not be needed. But if you want key rotation, if you want that, you know, DID document extensibility that DIDs will give you, like it becomes an option writing that users, holders, DIDs like on the chain. Like that's, I think, the minimum.
All right. Sorry, that was a lot. Again, as I said in the beginning, right? Like SSI or like DIDs is not exactly my big specialty. I'm more in the blockchain world. So I do want to make one quick comment. I think we're mostly out of time, but you mentioned, like, can we have a public place to look up an identifier to a key? And the GDPR answer is no, we cannot. If you don't have the option to remove the identifier to key mapping from that ledger. And that is kind of literally the text in GDPR. Yeah, I think we're kind of out of time, but I'm happy to take more questions offline. I think my email address is probably in the minutes somewhere.
No, I haven't included that, but Nico, we can follow up after the meeting, and then we can send over the contact information to those who
want to call. Some of this discussion is detailed enough, you know, just like cheer hat on and jumping in since we're like out of time, but like, you know, Nico, if you don't mind, I mean, having some of this discussion on the list could be really helpful because there's a lot of interesting nuance here. And this is part of what builds up this body of knowledge that lets us actually go ask and answer these questions better in the future and refine them and identify questions we didn't think about asking, et cetera. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. I'm happy to join discussions on the list, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Nico. And thanks, everyone, for joining this week's W3C CCG meeting. Again, Nico, thanks a lot for taking the time to present your findings. And then thanks, everyone, for a very interesting discussion. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. Bye.